Good morning and welcome to the Wednesday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. Review: Apple's new watch only partly frees you from your iPhone. By Lisa Edichico. The Good offers LTE connectivity without a bulky design, can now measure flights of stairs climbed. The Bad: expensive and not all third-party apps work without your phone. Who should buy? With LTE support, integrated GPS, and better health tracking, the Apple Watch Series 3 is Apple's most comprehensive smartwatch yet. But the LTE is only worth the extra monthly expense if you feel burdened by your smartphone. When Apple introduced the Apple Watch in 2014, CEO Tim Cook used the word personal to describe it. In some ways, he was right. The watch is a device that's meant to be worn on the wrist in full display all and every day, not tucked away in a pocket or purse. It knows how fast your heart is beating, can nudge you when someone calls, and lets you pay for things without reaching for a wallet or iPhone. For all that our smartphones rule our lives, Apple wanted its smart watch to be a semi-liberating alternative. For all it's done to free up those functions, it can still feel shackling. The Apple Watch is literally a miniature wrist-sized computer, but it relies on your iPhone to do all the heavy lifting. Without a Bluetooth tether to your phone or a connection to a compatible Wi-Fi network, your Apple Watch is a glorified pedometer with a clock. That's finally starting to change with the Apple Watch Series 3. It's the company's first smartwatch to have a cellular radio built in, which means it can connect to data networks all by itself. That's by far its biggest improvement. But it also includes a processor that's 70% faster, a barometric altimeter for measuring elevation, and a new wireless chip dubbed W2 for improving Wi-Fi performance. The Series 3 with LTE starts at $399, but you can also opt for a version of the Series 3 without cellular support for $329. The Series 3 definitely did more to separate me from my phone than any other smartwatch I've tested. Apple's smartwatch isn't the first to support cellular connectivity. Plenty of others, including Samsung and LG, have offered it for a long time. But Apple's watch is the only one that's both sleek and comfortable enough for me to want to keep it on my wrist all day. The number one question my friends and family members ask about buying a smartwatch is, what's the point if I have to keep my phone nearby? Cellular connectivity addresses that concern, but the Series 3 still relies on your iPhone more than I'd expected. For instance, I left my phone at home during a hike with friends and was able to successfully send and receive texts as well as initiate phone calls, but I could do little else. Several apps I frequently use, including Instagram, Yelp, Twitter, Slack, and Yahoo Fantasy, for example, still require that your phone be nearby in order to work. The Apple Watch's cellular connectivity covers important basics: making calls, sending texts, checking email, or getting directions through Apple Maps. And in the near future, it'll support streaming tunes from Apple Music. Apps like Dark Sky, Yumly, Uber, and Lyft also work independently on the watch. But several other things I like to do, say checking Twitter or Instagram while waiting in line for a coffee, still require the phone's presence. Apple's smartwatch isn't meant to be a smartphone replacement, but it is supposed to keep you in the loop when your phone isn't nearby. At this point, that's a question of app support. If there's an app you can't live without and expect to function independently on the new Apple Watch, you'll want to verify its developer supports the new LTE functionality. As a texting tool, the watch is sufficient for sending simple replies, but isn't designed for full conversations. I answered a text from my sister by tracing letters on the watch's screen to spell words. As with past models, the watch translated my swipes with little error. But spelling words takes time, and the Apple Watch is better suited for dispatching pithy, pre-written responses that appear as selectable options like, "Sure," and "No problem," or "Sorry, can't talk right now." Making calls from the watch didn't feel as convenient as from my phone, but it's reliable enough for quick voice chats. I could hear recipients clearly without having to hold the watch to my ear. I simply asked Siri to make a phone call while typing at my keyboard and was able to connect and begin talking without lifting my wrist. You'll probably want a pair of Bluetooth headphones if you plan on taking phone calls often, since the watch itself, while fine in a pinch, is a mediocre speakerphone. Keeping a charger handy is also essential if you plan to take a lot of calls on the watch while away from your phone. A 2.5-minute phone call dropped my watch's battery from 73 to 69%, and Apple says the new watch is good for up to an hour of LTE talking tops. Not that leaving LTE tanks the battery. In my tests and outside of calls, the Series 3 watch had comparable battery life to last year's Series 2. You'll still have to charge the watch nightly, and power-hungry features like calls or running with GPS enabled will drain the battery quickly. But if you're an average user, you shouldn't have trouble getting through a day off a single charge. Many Apple Watch reviewers also reported connectivity issues and inconsistencies due to a bug that prompts the watch to connect to Wi-Fi networks when it shouldn't. I didn't experience this during my testing and was able to access LTE wherever I usually have Verizon service with my iPhone, but it's worth noting. Apple says it's looking into the issue and a fix is presumably forthcoming. Because the new Apple Watch has a more powerful processor, Siri can respond to you verbally through the watch for the first time. I can't think of many situations in which I'd need to use Siri when my phone or Mac isn't nearby. But if you do, say, want to set a reminder while at the gym or going to pick up the laundry, Siri works pretty well on the wrist. As was the case with phone calls, Siri's responses are usually audible enough to hear without raising your hand. Playing catch-up to Fitbit, the Apple Watch Series 3 finally has a barometric altimeter. That means the new watch can measure how many flights of stairs you climb in a day, which it then factors into your daily activity readings. It'll also show changes in elevation as a new metric during a workout, which can be useful for those who frequently run uphill. It may sound like a minor addition, but it's another indication that fitness tracking is no longer a side bet for the Apple Watch. Apple is slowly but surely closing the gap between the Apple Watch and Fitbit's line of fitness trackers in measuring versatility. After spending several days with the Apple Watch Series 3, I found it to be most helpful in day-to-day scenarios like running quick errands in my neighborhood or stepping out to lunch during the workday. In those instances, I felt safe leaving my phone and purse behind, knowing that I'd still be able to receive incoming calls or texts. But priorities and carrier preferences are going to vary, and it's worth shopping around. You can get the Apple Watch Series 1 for $249, which is $150 cheaper than the LTE Apple Watch. It can't connect to LTE networks, manage GPS without a phone, or keep water out if you go for a swim, but it's enough for managing notifications when your phone's tucked away in a bag or pants pocket. The Apple Watch Series 3 also has a hidden cost. You'll have to pay your carrier an extra $10 per month to add it to your data plan. And if your heart is set on LTE, you'll want to consider alternatives like the LG Watch Sport, which is much cheaper at $249. Apple never intended the Series 1 or 2 Apple Watch to replace your phone, and with the Series 3, it still doesn't. Your smartphone is generally a better choice for just about every task the watch can perform, save for fitness tracking and checking the time. Support for cellular connectivity is a big step toward Apple's smartwatch independence, but in some ways it's also an incremental one. Unless you're already an iPhone user, and unless you're craving a phone-independent fitness tracker that folds neatly into Apple's Appverse, the Series 3's LTE is more of a novelty than a bedrock feature that's fully worth the added expense. I give it 3.5 out of 5. Saudi Arabia will finally allow women to drive cars. By Jared Malzin in Cairo. Saudi Arabia's government announced on Tuesday that it will grant women the right to drive cars next year in a major sign of social change for the ultra-conservative kingdom. The civil rights breakthrough follows years of civil disobedience since the 1990s by women demanding the right to drive in a country whose social mores have been constrained since its founding in 1932 by a conservative religious establishment. The decision on Tuesday came in the form of a decree issued by Saudi Arabia's King Salman bin Abdul Aziz Al Saud. We refer to the negative consequences of not allowing women to drive vehicles and the positive aspects of allowing them to do so, the government wrote in a royal decree. The royal directive also comes during a time of turbulence in Saudi Arabia's political system following the elevation in June of a new crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, who is 32 and set to inherit the country's reins of power in the coming years. Bin Salman is seen by some as a supporter of some social reforms and is also in charge of overhauling the Saudi economy, but his rise to power also triggered a government clampdown, including the arrest of prominent religious figures. Advocates of women's rights in the kingdom responded with elation to the government's decision. "I'm in tears," tweeted Manal al-Sharif, a prominent activist for women's right to drive and the author of a book on the subject. "This is an historic development and a milestone for the kingdom," said Mohammed Khalid Al-Yahya, a Saudi analyst with the Atlantic Council in Washington. "Young people in Saudi Arabia have been waiting for change." Bin Salman is the public face of a plan to transform the Saudi economy that calls for equal participation of men and women in the workplace. In the announcement on Tuesday, the Saudi ambassador to Washington framed the decision to allow women to drive in economic terms. "It's not just a social change, it's part of economic reform," he was quoted as saying by Saudi media. Saudi Arabia had been the only country to deny women the right to drive, and as a result, the ban stood as a symbol of the kingdom's international isolation. The Saudi government faces resistance from a conservative religious establishment that often opposes easing of social restrictions in the kingdom, which is the home of Islam's two holiest sites, Mecca and Medina. Tuesday's announcement comes at the culmination of an era of political tension in the Saudi kingdom. Last week, the Saudi government launched a crackdown on critics of the current regime, arresting at least 16 people, including prominent religious figures, academics, and journalists. In July, Saudi security forces sealed off a predominantly Shiite town in the country's east.
Roy Moore's victory in Alabama is bad news for the establishment GOP, by Maya Rodan. As the results came in on Tuesday night, it was increasingly clear that the former Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, Roy Moore, was going to be the Republican nominee for Attorney General Jeff Sessions' old Senate seat. The defeat of incumbent Senator Luther Strange in Tuesday's runoff election was a win for the anti-establishment right wing of the Republican Party, whose heavy hitters stumped for Moore in the campaign. At a rowdy Monday night rally, former White House chief strategist Steve Bannon told a crowd in Fairhope, Alabama, that the Tuesday night runoff would give Alabamians an opportunity to stick it to Washington elites. "They think you're nothing but rubes," Bannon said of establishment Republicans, "and tomorrow you're going to get an opportunity to tell them what you think of the elites who run this country." And so they did. At around 8 p.m., with 13% of precincts reporting, Moore led Strange by 17 points. By 8:30 p.m. Central Time, the Associated Press declared Strange the winner, dealing a blow to President Trump and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, both of whom supported the incumbent candidate in the race. There were reports that President Donald Trump, who traveled to Alabama last week to campaign for Strange, was bracing for a loss heading into election night. According to Politico, on Monday night, Trump consulted with a group of conservative activists he'd met with about what kind of fallout he could face if Moore won, and had been complaining about having to stump for Strange throughout the campaign. Yet, with his former staffer supporting the other candidate, who aligned more with Trump in terms of style than his opponent, Trump has made it clear that he would have no problem campaigning for Moore if it came to that. "I told Luther, and I have to say this, if his opponent wins, I'm going to be here campaigning like hell for him," Trump said during a Monday interview with the Rick and Bubba radio show. Outside groups had weighed into the race, largely in efforts to boost Strange. The Senate Leadership Conference, the National Rifle Association, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce had all spent ad dollars to blast more as the race drew to a close. Those ads clearly didn't make a difference. And as political consultant and radio host Jack Campbell told Time, people down here don't like people telling them how to vote. Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana told Time on Tuesday that he did not believe the election would be a referendum on McConnell, but rather a mirror of the 2016 presidential contest. The voters, the ordinary people of Alabama, are sick of Washington, Kennedy said. They feel let down. They're trying to figure out if they just ought to throw up their hands and totally ignore Washington. They've been BS'd for a long time, and they're naturally cynical. To voters in Alabama, too, Strange had baggage. Both his connection to embattled former Alabama Governor Rob Bentley, who appointed Strange as the former Attorney General's office was investigating him, and his links to McConnell, who has been pilloried by Moore's supporters, were seen as negatives. If Moore wins the special election on December 12th, which is very likely in this deep red state, it could mean trouble for McConnell when the fiery conservative is sworn in. Democrats in Alabama, however, are hopeful that with such a controversial character at the top of the Republican ticket, they could have a fighting chance. I really think either way, Democrats are in a good position, Nancy Worley, chairwoman of the Democratic Party in Alabama, said in an interview with Time. Looking forward, Moore's win signals trouble for the Republican establishment that was already concerned about the prospect of vulnerable incumbents facing primary challenges from Moore-like characters. But if Bannon has his way, Moore's win is only the beginning.
Will and Grace hasn't changed much, but that's mostly fine. By Daniel Dario. The first thing you need to know about the new Will and Grace, which debuts on NBC Thursday, is that they've changed the theme song. Presumably, you'll be more curious about, say, how the show's signature rat-a-tat comic timing holds up after more than a decade off the air, or how the show explains away a fairly conclusive finale that would make the show's current existence as an ensemble comedy, Will and Grace were supposed to be estranged until about 8 years from now, impossible. But really, the music says it all. The iconically already way too much theme, with its Liberace-esque pounding piano chords, has been replaced by a jazzy orchestra. The show is keeping the same tune, but in an attempt to make it sound bigger and more spectacular, the result is a little off. It's easy to see why bringing back Will and Grace was appealing. Today's television landscape rewards the spectacle of an old favorite returning, including the upcoming Roseanne. There's also a sense that the culture is now vastly more open to gay narratives than it was when the sitcom debuted in 1998. But it's also easy to see what the show stands to lose in revamping its formula for contemporary audiences. The jokes are bigger at the expense of the humanity the show put front and center in its first run. When we left Will and Grace, Eric McCormick and Deborah Messing, in the punitive series finale in 2006, they were on the verge of spending 18 years apart, not as a result of one big argument, though the show's eighth and then final season had its share of those, but simply because they were growing apart. Each was committed to his or her own newfound family life with their respective loving spouse. The pair only connected again in a flash forward when they dropped off their kids at, gasp, the same college. While both were happy to reconnect, neither seemed to feel particularly heartbroken over the long absence. Life gets in the way sometimes, and life is often good. It was a very weird finale, but it made its point. The new Will and Grace takes an industrial-sized eraser to the show's own canon, declaring that the kids, such a long-held dream of Will and Grace that they consume seemingly seasons worth of plot, were a dream the pill-addicted Karen, Megan Mullally, had. The spouses? They were real, but both marriages ended in divorce. Will and Grace are free to frolic. In the first episode, for instance, both go to President Trump's White House, Will to obsessively follow a cute congressman he's been pursuing, okay, and Grace to test drive for potential redesign of the Oval Office, okay. Both characters seem frantic in their pitching of punchlines, unmoored from character history and reality in a manner that doesn't suit the show. For better and mainly worse, Will and Grace was always like the other much-ballyhooed must-see TV hit, Friends, a series that was relentlessly about its characters' love lives, sometimes at the expense of reason. I was no particular fan of Grace's old husband, Leo, Harry Connick Jr., and the ways in which his love plotline seemed to take over the show. But there is a painful and political charge to ending the marriage of Will to Vince, Bobby Cannavale. A noteworthy gay character in television history got a conditionally happy ending, and that's been ripped away to service a retread happy TV landscape. Also, that the character himself can go to the White House to obsessively follow a cute congressman. Rarely does an opportunity feel missed by not having done something. But the chance to leave Will where he was, a married with child gay man at a time when everything about that descriptor was provocative, feels like a road not taken. But the market is what it is. This reboot was going to happen the moment last year's election-pegged YouTube video became a viral hit. That proved the characters were missed, and rewatching old episodes on Hulu recently has proven to me just how worth missing they were. Say this much, the humor is tired in the old, comforting way. Karen, and especially Jack, Sean Hayes, two of TV's most ingenious supporting characters, spark with all their old wit. A sequence in which Jack acts out wearing some horrific movement-restricting version of Spanx is the best of the first three episodes. Elsewhere, Grace, planning to redecorate the Oval Office, holds a Cheeto against a swatch of fabric to ensure the tones will flatter the president's skin tone, a joke most political observers have moved on from. Will and Grace has no real angle on Trump, let alone the sort of take that would justify a DC-set episode. But there's a broad berth one is willing to grant, if for no reason other than nostalgia. I have no particular nostalgic bond with recently revived series like The X-Files and Gilmore Girls, but Will and Grace can override better judgment when it hits its rhythm. And not all the political tones the show strikes are quite repetitious. Will, on a date with a 23-year-old, Ben Platt, plays himself stunned not only that the kid hasn't heard Madonna's Borderline, but that he hasn't heard of Stonewall. The urgency with which Will lectures him, repeating his history with the knowledge that if it's not known and cherished, it could fall away, feels special. Did it need to be aired in a revival of a show whose bright spots, brilliant performances, great rapport, and whose flaws, oh my God, it's Jennifer Lopez, Janet Jackson, Cher, Madonna. I was happy having left in my own rear view? Probably not. But even as so much seems off, a lot or a little, it doesn't seem a net loss to have four queer or queer-ally characters in prime time on network TV at a time in which any companionship is welcome. Forget Borderline, and forget the horrid new theme, for all it tells us about the show. The tune that runs through my mind was a gay club hit from 1999, just after the show premiered. It's not right, but it's okay.
The Friendly Habit That Could Be Killing Your Credibility, by Richard Moy for The Muse. Sometimes I overanalyze work emails to the point where I think everyone's mad at me for everything I've done. So when I write them, I usually include a healthy combination of exclamation marks and friendly emojis to communicate very clearly that I am not upset. And up until this week, I thought that was the right idea. But according to new research, it turns out that my habit is actually a really bad one, and it's apparently killing my credibility at work. A team of researchers at Ben-Gurion University of the Negev in Israel discovered that not only do emojis fail to convey the warm feelings I thought I was communicating, but that they also decrease perceptions of competence. And they didn't come to this conclusion based on surveying just one office. In fact, this finding was based on responses from 549 people across 29 different countries. Ouch! This might sound familiar to some of you. And for those of you who are suddenly feeling embarrassed, you're probably wondering what's next for people like us. Do we ignore the research and keep communicating with smiley faces to show our teammates that they have nothing to worry about? Do we go against what feels natural and ditch them altogether, even if that means that our emails suddenly take a much colder tone? Well, the answer to both is actually a resounding yes, and there are two parts to that answer. For starters, you shouldn't feel obligated to delete your emoji keyboard. I bet you have some work relationships that were built on a foundation of exchanging them, and that's totally okay.
For the emails between just the two of you, feel free to carry on as you have. There's nothing wrong with having someone at work who understands that certain combinations of emojis mean that you need a snack break ASAP. But for those messages that address actual business issues, trust what the research says and save the wink face for more casual discussions. After all, the researchers found that even a smiley that seems well-placed doesn't replace an in-person smile. As for me, it might take a while to come to grips with all of this. I've written some emails since reviewing the research, and without my normal levels of internet enthusiasm, it's hard for me to recognize who wrote them. But I have noticed that some exchanges have been shorter than others, and it's probably because I'm getting right to the point. Thanksgiving flights are cheapest right now. Here's how to get the best deals. By Brad Tuttle. If you haven't already purchased airline tickets for the Thanksgiving holidays, it's time to act quickly or be prepared to pay a steep price. It's best to book flights for the Christmas period sooner than later as well. Data from the travel search engine and research site HipMonk.com indicates that travelers will save 27% on average by booking Thanksgiving flights this week compared to the week before the holiday. The average round-trip flight price for a domestic route during the holidays costs $374 if the ticket is purchased this week versus $476 in the days before Thanksgiving. If you're not ready to book flights now, it's really in your best interest to at least get your act together by around Halloween. The average Thanksgiving flight costs $385 if booked by the end of October, according to HipMonk. After that, flight prices increase dramatically. Research from Expedia also recommends booking Thanksgiving flights at least 60 days in advance, so right about now, to get the lowest prices. Meanwhile, a new report from Hopper.com stresses the importance of booking Thanksgiving flights no later than Halloween. Thanksgiving airfare tends to be very stable during the month of October, so prices won't vary much, but make sure you book before the week of Halloween, Hopper chief data scientist Patrick Surrey writes. If you wait until early November to book your flight, it'll cost you about $1 per day you wait. Then prices begin spiking by $10 per day during the final 2 weeks leading up to Thanksgiving. If possible, you should try to nail down plans and book tickets for Christmas travel far in advance as well. The HipMonk study shows that the average Christmas time flight costs $365 if booked the week of September 25th, rising to $384 for bookings made at the end of October. Either price point is way better than tickets purchased the week before Christmas. By then, the average flight costs over $500. Even though holiday period flights are generally cheaper if you book now, the precise days you fly can still make a big difference in how much you pay. Availability of the cheapest seats on any given plane is always limited, and the lowest price tickets for peak demand days like the Wednesday before Thanksgiving and the Sunday after Thanksgiving are often already sold out. OBGYN to Congress, repeal the Hyde Amendment, not Obamacare. By Kristen Brandy. As an obstetrician-gynecologist, I love bringing essential care to the women I work with. Tragically, there are certain federal restrictions that prevent me from being able to provide all my patients with the services they need and deserve, no matter how motivated I may be to help. The Graham-Cassidy bill to repeal the Affordable Care Act, currently being considered by the Senate, would make these restrictions even more severe, threatening reproductive health care coverage for my patients and for people nationwide. Yet even if Republicans fail in their efforts to dismantle the ACA, the fight for access to affordable and equitable reproductive health care, especially abortion care, will be far from over. The ongoing deliberation around comprehensive reproductive health care has heard the voices of politicians and angry voters alike, but not the voice of doctors. We have spoken out again and again against a damaging policy that must be revoked, the Hyde Amendment. The Hyde Amendment, which was passed 41 years ago this week, withholds abortion coverage from those reliant on the government for their insurance, and its renewal is included in the Graham-Cassidy bill. Those impacted include, but are not limited to, those enrolled in Medicaid, federal employees, military personnel. The list goes on. Except in the limited cases of rape, incest, or life endangerment, patients who come to me and fall into any of these broad sweeping categories are unable to access affordable abortion care. Members of Congress have the opportunity to change this harmful policy each year when Hyde has to be renewed, but so far they've failed. Organizations like the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and representatives from different specialties have voiced their opinions about the Hyde Amendment for years, unanimously encouraging their representatives to vote against it. These organizations and the doctors they represent know firsthand the effects Hyde has on patients across the country. And so do I. I can speak personally to those who have been negatively affected by the Hyde Amendment and what upholding Hyde will take away for women and families of the future. One of my patients, while home on a break from military service, was thrilled to learn she was pregnant. But in her second trimester, she learned her baby had a fetal anomaly that was not compatible with life if she delivered, and decided the best thing for her baby was to end the pregnancy. We were happy to take care of her in this vulnerable time, but because of the Hyde Amendment, the procedure would not be covered by her insurance. Our team and outside support services worked tirelessly to scrape together the money to help my patient pay for the abortion. Many women are not so lucky. The only healthcare debate worth having is one that improves access for all people, starting with the repeal of the Hyde Amendment. Congress calls upon experts when making important decisions for our country. OBGYNs are here, ready to be heard. Dr. Kristen Brandy is a Los Angeles-based OBGYN and a member of Physicians for Reproductive Health.
Why We Must Not Build Automated Weapons of War, by Paul Shari. Shari is a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security and author of the forthcoming book Army of None, Autonomous Weapons and the Future of War. Over 100 CEOs of artificial intelligence and robotics firms recently signed an open letter warning that their work could be repurposed to build lethal autonomous weapons, so-called killer robots. They argued that to build such weapons would be to open a Pandora's box. This could forever alter war. Over 30 countries have or are developing armed drones, and with each successive generation, drones have more autonomy. Automation has long been used in weapons to help identify targets and maneuver missiles, but to date, humans have remained in control of deciding whether to use lethal force. Militaries have only used automated engagements in limited settings to defend against high-speed rockets and missiles. Advances in autonomous technology could change that. The same intelligence that allows self-driving cars to avoid pedestrians could allow future weapons that hunt and attack targets on their own. For the past 3 years, countries have met through the United Nations to discuss lethal autonomous weapons. Over 60 non-governmental organizations have called for a treaty banning autonomous weapons. Yet most countries are hedging their bets. No major military powers have said they plan to build autonomous weapons, but few have taken them off the table. There's a certain irony in the CEOs of robotics and AI companies warning of the dangers of the very same technologies they themselves are building. They implore countries to double their efforts in international negotiations and warn that we do not have long to act. But if the situation is truly dire, couldn't these companies slow their research to buy diplomats more time? In reality, even if all of these companies stopped research, the field of AI would continue marching forward. The intelligence behind autonomous robots isn't like stealth technology, which was created in secret defense labs and tightly controlled by the military. Autonomous technology is everywhere. Hobbyist drones that retail for a few $100s can take off, land, follow moving objects, and avoid obstacles all on their own. Elementary school students build robots in competitions. Even the Islamic State is getting in on the game, strapping bombs to small drones. There's no stopping AI. Robotics companies can't easily band together to stop progress because it only takes one company to break the agreement and advance the technology. Besides, to ask companies to stop research would be to ask them to forego innovations that could generate profits and save lives. These same dynamics make constraining autonomous weapons internationally very difficult. Asking countries to sign a treaty banning a weapon that doesn't yet exist means asking them to forego a potentially useful tool to defend against threats and save lives. Moreover, the same problem of cheaters applies in the international arena, but the stakes are higher. Instead of lost profits, a nation might lose a war. History suggests that even when the international community widely condemns a weapon as inhumane, like chemical weapons, some despots will use them anyway. Treaties alone won't prevent rogue regimes and terrorists from building autonomous weapons. If autonomous weapons led to a decisive advantage in war, a treaty that disarmed only those who care for the rule of law would be the worst of all possible worlds. The letter signers likely understand this, which may be why the letter doesn't call for a ban, a notable departure from a similar letter 2 years ago. Instead, the signatories ask countries at the United Nations to find a way to protect us from all these dangers. Banning or regulating emerging weapons technologies is easier said than done, though. Nations have tried to ban crossbows, firearms, surprise attacks by submarines, aerial attacks on cities, and in World War I, poison gas. All have failed. And yet, nations held back from using poison gas on the battlefields of World War II. The Cold War saw treaties banning chemical and biological weapons, using the environment as a weapon, and placing nuclear weapons in space or on the seabed. The United States and Soviet Union pulled back from neutron bombs and anti-satellite weapons even without formal treaties. Nuclear weapons have proliferated, but not as widely as many predicted. In more recent years, nations have passed bans on blinding lasers, landmines, and cluster munitions. Weapons are easier to ban when few countries have access to them, when they're widely seen as horrifying, and when they provide little military benefits. It's extremely difficult to ban weapons that are seen as giving a decisive advantage, as nuclear weapons are. A major factor in what will happen with autonomous weapons, therefore, is how nations come to see the benefits and risks they pose. Autonomous weapons pose a classic security dilemma for countries. All countries may be better off without them, but mutual restraint requires cooperation. Last year, nations agreed to create a more formal group of governmental experts to study the issue. The group will convene in November, and once again, nations will attempt to halt a potentially dangerous technology before it's used in war. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.